So interesting. This song is a song that I've always disliked. It's one of those that I'm like, it was at the height of just the sort of wrought, sort of over-sensationalized Tupac, you know, everything in there. But after reading your book, Ben, I'm like, I want to go back in to all this music again. I mean, it really is something intense, if that's the right word.
Yes, it was all intense, wall-to-wall.
Last year, the movie Straight Outta Compton told the story of the controversial rap group N.W.A. The movie was very successful, garnering nominations during award season, but there was some controversy around the movie. It was produced by Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, so a lot of the plot skimmed over some of the more negative aspects of the band's story, including criminal activity and violence towards women. But it's impossible to understate how important N.W.A. was to the music landscape in the late 80s, early 90s. And the members of that rap group, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E, they've become synonymous with the West Coast rap sound. Then factor in Suge Knight, Snoop Dogg, Death Row Records, Nate Dogg, Warren G, Tupac. What an ensemble of musicians. And it's hard to forget how the West Coast and East Coast rap scenes feuded in the 90s, remember that, including the untimely deaths of Biggie and Tupac. But did you know that that beef was actually settled right here in Chicago? Ben Westhoff tells the untold story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the birth of West Coast rap in his new book, Original Gangsters. Ben is a former writer for LA Weekly as well as a freelance music journalist. He's also written the book Dirty South, Outkast, Lil Wayne, Soulja Boy, and the Southern Rappers That Reinvented Hip Hop. He's in town for a reading at Volumes Book Cafe, 1474 North Milwaukee, tomorrow night. It's a pleasure to have Ben at the big table here in studio. Ben, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks for having me,
What a
Justin.
Book. I mean, I've been talking about the first hour. I feel like I had 24 hours in your words. I mean, it's just been like I looked up last night at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, uh-oh. I've been reading for far too long. But what compelled you to write this book? Because this is a story that, with Straight Outta Compton and others, I mean, the West Coast rap scene has been covered.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of this music when I was in high school, and albums like Dr. Dre's The Chronic and Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style came out, and it was like the biggest thing in my high school. And I became a journalist, and I was working in L.A., and I got the chance to interview a lot of my idols. I got to meet Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, Ice-T, people like that. And the thing was, as a journalist, not just a music critic, but as a music journalist, I knew I could go a lot deeper. And I really poured through the court records. I interviewed everyone I could find. I interviewed people in jail, yeah, gang members. And I knew there was a lot more to the story just because things were so insanely crazy during that era.
Well, the story starts with N.W.A., which is what we mentioned with the movie Straight Outta Compton. But it really starts with Eazy-E, who was the man who put together N.W.A. and sort of was the star of and really the origin story of West Coast rap.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Eazy was, when you think of N.W.A. and you think of who they are with the sort of the violent imagery, the sort of gang related themes, that came from Eazy. Now, Dr. Dre hated gangs. Ice Cube came up in a relatively well-to-do family, and the other members weren't really into the scene like Eazy, but Eazy sold crack cocaine. He was a member of the Crips, and he wasn't a rapper at first. His idea was that the other guys would kind of take what his style and run with it.
This is a business opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. He took his money that he made selling crack and wanted to go legit. But Dr. Dre heard his voice, he saw his image, and he said, you know, you should really give this a try. And it all kind of launched from there.
You know, it is interesting because one of the, I'm reading back through here, and I, you know, I think we're of the same age in the way that, you know, N.W.A. was a big part of my generation, my childhood. There and all of the controversy surrounding it, from parental guidance notices on the records and everything in between, politicians speaking out. But there really was sort of this glorification of guns, drugs, and violence. And you're right, Eazy-E was all of that. I mean, for as much as there's storylines about, you know, people just sort of being entertainers and not necessarily thugs or criminals, this was the real deal.
Yeah, Eazy-E, they didn't like the term gangster rap. They preferred to call themselves reality rappers. And the way N.W.A. saw it was they were just going to call it like they saw it, like life really was. And this was the crack era. This was the era where the Crips and the Bloods were at war with each other, and homicide violence was at like an all-time high practically in LA. So they weren't sensationalizing it all that much. They were kind of telling what was going on. And with Easy, it was about, he wasn't trying to preach, you know. There's a lot of this, like, at the end of the after school special, they tell you, but kids, drugs and guns are bad.
Right.
And Easy was not having that.
It's fascinating too, because Pete and I were talking about it just before we started this hour, the concept that there was so much discord and chaos around relationships in the communities of, you know, the West. And I'm thinking in L.A., Inglewood or South Central
Compton,
L.A.
South Central,
Compton,
yeah.
with police. And there, you know, NWA had a lot of, had a huge hit off of Straight Outta Compton, but they also had a lot of lyrics that were about their relationship with the police. It's interesting to think about that almost 30 years ago, that was a huge thread through the music that was being produced and performed by rappers in African-American communities.
Yeah, absolutely. NWA had F the Police, and they've had all these protests in recent years in places like Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, you know, with these shootings of unarmed black men by white police. And F the Police by NWA is still being played. You still hear it coming out of cars nowadays. It was the soundtrack for the LA riots. And then after that, of course, there was Ice-T with Cop Killer,
right,
which was even more controversial and almost brought down the whole Time Warner company when that came out.
Ben Westhoff's book is Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. It's a great book, and it really does sort of capture this moment, this generation that, I mean, it takes me back to being, you know, a 16-year-old kid and how much of this was a part of the diet of mainstream America and how it got there. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a quick break here on The Download, and we'll continue with Ben. Stay with us.
Brothers out there flaking and perpetrating but scared to kick reality.
Man, you've been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what time it is.
So what you want me to do?
Spread yourself.
I'm expressing with my full capabilities. And now I'm living in correctional facilities. Because some don't agree with...
Ben Westhoff's my guest in studio here on 720 WGN. We're talking about the book, Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. Love that this song is the one we're playing here. Because it brings up... And I want to talk about this because we'll talk a little bit later about... These guys are writing raps for each other. You know, when you think of the way rap music is written, you think that Dr. Dre is writing his story and he puts it down. But these are, I remember sort of making a mental note that, you know, that was a Dr. Dre rap written by Ice Cube.
Probably Ice Cube.
Yeah, but the idea being that they wrote each other's kind of stories and raps, and it's not necessarily what you think of, that it's just this one rapper just always writing his story. There's a lot of ghostwriting that goes into rap.
Yeah, Dr. Dre in particular, he's always had the producer's ear. And for him, the whole song has different instruments and the rapping is just one of those instruments. So he's had people like the DOC, kind of the unofficial sixth member of NWA, and Ice Cube, Jay-Z, everybody is written for him over the years.
It's interesting because there's been so much made in hip hop about some of the current stars, whether it be Kanye West or Drake. Sort of getting into beefs about not writing their own material. And it's interesting to look back at some of the pioneers of this music, and they never said that they wrote necessarily the lyrics that they were rapping.
Yeah, Eazy-E certainly didn't either. The DOC kind of crafted him into a character who was supposed to be kind of like Flavor Flav from Public Enemy, sort of tough, but with sort of comic relief aspect to him.
Yeah. Ben, it's interesting because a lot of this music obviously played well. I mean, it's so interesting about Skateland and the places in South Central that communities really came after this reality rap. They really loved it. But it wasn't until it got to, I mean, it was the kind of music that really went mainstream. And mainstream, I guess, means getting into the hands of young white kids in Minnesota like yourself or myself in Chicago or wherever, where they had never heard anything like this. And talk about that experience, because that's really where NWA and West Coast rap exploded, the idea of white kids in the Midwest and places, other places listening to it.
Yeah, I think it was surprising at first to the people distributing this music that it was so popular with white kids. But my group of friends in Minnesota, we, you know, it was just part of the culture. And we thought of Compton as a place that was dangerous, but was like the epitome of cool somehow. And we, you know, it was rebellious music. It was the same way that our parents tried to shock their parents by listening to the Rolling Stones, we listened to NWA and The Chronic and things like that that had the parental warning stickers. And it was our way of kind of, I don't want to say fetishizing another culture, but there certainly was some of that. And, you know, we imitated the styles and put up these ridiculous gang signs. And it's embarrassing to talk about it. It's not very politically correct, but I think it appealed because the music was so great ultimately.
And there's a lot of, you know, you kind of underscore a little bit when you talk about, you know, the reaction to the music, to the gangster rap, especially the West Coast gangster rap. There was a lot of political posturing. I mean, it's funny to read Dan Quayle and Tipper Gore, and we all remember that. But there was a lot of sort of, this is dangerous music, and they're writing about, or they're rapping about things that, you know, that we shouldn't have in our society. But then on the other side of town, or in the other side of the dial, you had bands like Guns N' Roses or some of the sort of hair metal bands rapping about this, or not rapping, but singing about the same concepts, misogynistic lyrics, all that kind of stuff. But there wasn't that. So there's these hints of like sort of double standard hypocrisy and this underlying racism when it comes to this kind of music.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was all kind of highlighted when the FBI wrote a letter to NWA. Basically, it was very oddly worded, but they were objecting to the song F the Police. And it was pretty much unprecedented for the FBI to take a stand.
They didn't say they were going to arrest them. They didn't say anything. They just said, we don't like this song.
Yeah, it was basically they were trying to intimidate them. And the group members ultimately, though, were very thankful for that letter because they publicized it and they were convinced that they sold a million more records because of it.
Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, are similar with musicians, but it really does play when we talked about this being reality rap. There were a lot of issues that, you know, as I mentioned in the lead, you know, the movie, which I saw Straight Outta Compton, just kind of glossed over the negative aspects of some of these bands and these artists and these, and when it comes to misogynistic lyrics and domestic violence, violence against women. A lot of times you'll hear the rappers say, oh, it's just we're rapping about this, we're using street language. But in this case, this was some really nasty stuff, especially particularly with Dr. Dre.
Yeah, Dr. Dre has been accused by four different women of domestic abuse, and I was able to find someone who had never been reported. Her name was Lisa Johnson. She's the mother of three of Dr. Dre's children, and she says that he beat her constantly, you know, regularly when they were together, including when she was pregnant in the 80s, and her allegations were substantiated by some court documents and also an eyewitness. So there was also, most famously, a television host named Dee Barnes, and Dr. Dre beat her at a party with a lot of witnesses. And we talk about in the book how some bodyguards allegedly like kept people away, so who were trying to interject to help her. And she ultimately took him to court, and he got probation and community service, but the other women didn't. So it was there wasn't really a lot known about this until Straight Outta Compton came out, the movie, last year. And he, like you were saying, he really glossed over it, didn't have any of that in the movie. And a lot of people objected to that. And so that's when all this stuff really...
And it's interesting, too, because he's been on record talking about it. He kind of had a little bit of an apology around the movie. Like, he came out and you use it in the book, just as sort of like, what I did back then was bad, and I'm sorry for who I hurt. But along the way, there wasn't a lot of statements that Dr. Dre would make to these allegations saying, oh, no, I did not do this. He just kind of said, you know, deal with it.
Yeah, and the other group members in NWA really made some alarming statements about Dee Barnes, like she deserved it and things like that. So and when he made his apology, a lot of people didn't think it went far enough. He didn't name specific people that he was apologizing to. Like, for example, Michelle A, his old girlfriend, who was an R&B singer, very successful in her own right, just came out with a biopic that lays out all her allegations against him, the beatings, and so that she's finally getting her say.
It's interesting, especially when you think about not just, I mean, obviously domestic violence, but the criminal charges, the gun charges, the drug charges that are on these guys. Not to mention, I mean, early on you set the stage for at least for Dre and for Eazy-E to have, I mean, I think they fathered 10 to 12 different children each, all different moms,
yeah,
all the way across.
I think Dre and Eazy had 10 children, and with Eazy, when he died of AIDS in 1995, there was a lot of concern that would the children be test positive? Would some of the mothers of the children? But none of them actually did. And that was strange because it stoked some conspiracy theories that he didn't actually have AIDS. So that's something that my book, Original Gangsters, goes into a great deal, is kind of all this 11th hour strangeness right before he died.
Oh, it's so, and they do a real quick sort of movie version of that in Hollywood where he gets a cough and the next thing you know, they're all crying. But there's a lot that went into that because it was such a strange time. I want to talk about, you know, we're going to take a break and get the news with Rob. I want to talk about the other players in your book, most notably Tupac Shakur. Obviously, the East Coast, West Coast feud really centered around how he sort of stepped up. I mean, obviously dying in a violent feud, as well as Biggie in the East Coast, and how that feud sort of was settled here in Chicago. So we'll talk about that. Ben Westhoff is the author of The Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us. It's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women, be real to our women. And if we don't, we'll have a race of babies that will hate the ladies that make the babies. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know you're fed up, ladies, but keep your head up. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Ben Westhoff. He is the author of Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's going to be at Volumes Book Cafe at 1474 North Milwaukee tomorrow night, hosted by Kevin Koval. You know, as we, you know, move on from N.W.A. and the stories of N.W.A., Dr. Dre makes a name for himself with the album The Chronic, considered one of the best rap albums of all time. Snoop Dogg, it plays a big, prominent role in this book. And it's interesting because it kind of goes from this sort of reality rap to this G thing, this idea that there's this gangstaism, as you just sort of say. But the idea that you don't necessarily, it's not gangsters rapping, it's almost like a feel instead. That's sort of what came out of it.
Yeah, Dr. Dre hated gangs, and he had been, you know, talking trash about them on his early music, but on Nothing But a G Thing, songs like that, the way I put it was that gangsterism became like literally a posture. Like it was sort of the way he stood. It's about standing up for yourself. It's about not taking crap from anyone.
It's less about colors and Bloods and Crips and more
exactly
about the feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Dr. Dre, I mean, you think back to even those videos, I mean, everything, that almost equates, because Snoop Dogg came from gang life.
Yeah, definitely. And Snoop was the one who introduced him to weed, because on the NWA song Express Yourself, which we heard earlier, Jay talks about how he hates weed. But then he did a big reverse course on that.
So let's talk about Snoop Dogg and, more importantly, Death Row Records. You know, it was in the movie as well, Straight Outta Compton, but there was a move from Ruthless Records, which was NWA and Eazy-E and Jerry Heller, to Death Row Records, which was Suge Knight. And that's where this as we know it, the popularizing of the beef came from. This is where more and more we saw Death Row Records taking, not only having diss tracks on records, but then being brawls at convention centers and fights at award shows. I mean, it really went from one thing to another pretty quick.
Yeah. At the center of the beef was Eazy-E and Dr. Dre themselves, who used to be best friends, but Dr. Dre released these diss tracks against Eazy on The Chronic. And at this point, they were actually living near each other, as I report in Original Gangsters. They lived in the same, like, private, wealthy community, and they'd see each other on the street now again, and kind of like Eazy said that Dre would sort of duck his head down. But it became a little more real. It wasn't just about disses on record, like rap has always had.
And that's been something that, from the origins of rap, as people who may not be familiar, the last track of a album was almost reserved for people to name check or diss on other rappers. And it was a tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And so this became kind of a transition where things got more and more real. And that would really culminate with Tupac Shakur, and he was assigned to Death Row, and they basically initiated a war with their East Coast rival, Bad Boy Records, which was led by Puff Daddy, and the most famous rapper was Biggie Smalls.
So then, and that, you know, as we said, the diss tracks became real. There was a spillover. First, it was Ruthless Records and Death Row Records in L.A. that would find each other on the street in some form and have some sort of all-out violent brawl. Then it became the East Coast and the West Coast as you say in the book, it's almost a misnomer to say it was East Coast, West Coast. It was two record labels.
Yeah, exactly. It was Death Row and Bad Boy. And it all started when Tupac was shot, not fatally, the first time in 1994. And he began to believe that Biggie, who had been his friend, knew about the shooting advance, knew he was going to be set up. And so he went on basically a tirade against Biggie and sort of initiated this dispute, which got more and more serious until Tupac was murdered in Las Vegas in 1996. And then Biggie was murdered 6 months later. Now, those murders are still unsolved, but as I explore in my book, there's a lot of reason to believe that the two labels were involved with one or both of those murders.
You know, there's a lot of theories and conspiracy theories around the concept, but there really does all lines sort of lead back to the different labels really had to do with essentially assassinating the other rapper.
Yeah, there's a cop named Greg Kading who worked on these cases for LAPD, and his theory is that Suge Knight basically paid a member of his entourage to kill Biggie, and that Puff Daddy may have paid someone to kill Tupac. Now, that case is less certain. It's kind of like this guy who says he was involved, his word versus Puffy's word. Puffy denies it, but there's a lot going on there, definitely.
Now, this is where the story turns to Chicago. And, you know, be sort of teasing out the idea because it really surrounds, and if you're a fan of rap, you are probably already picked it out. If you're not, you'd be surprised that the Nation of Islam and Louis Farrakhan played a big role in the early days of West Coast rap. He became almost a religious, spiritual leader or confidant to bands like N.W.A., to Ice Cube. There's a relationship between the Nation of Islam and the music.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a time when politicians, religious leaders, both black and white, were dissing hip-hop, especially gangster rap, and had no time for it at all. But Farrakhan really respected these performers, and the Nation of Islam would provide security. Like when Eazy-E was dying, the Nation of Islam was right there at his bedside to try to keep him safe. And when it came to after Tupac and Biggie's murders, Farrakhan personally put together a peace summit here in Chicago. Now, this was a really scary time for everyone in hip-hop. Everyone thought they might be next, that these were the two biggest stars at the height of their fame, gunned down with thousands of people around, you know, and still unsolved. So Farrakhan brought all these people together. He brought together representatives from Death Row, including Snoop Dogg, along with Ice Cube, who had a beef with Common.
You're in Chicago.
Here in Chicago,
right?
Brought in people from the South, people from the East, and basically put them all in a room together. And he was like, "You guys aren't leaving till you."
And he did it. He did it in his Hyde Park in the Palace, the where he lives.
Yep, exactly.
And so he brought all these rappers together, and it's kind of unknown. I mean, you talk about this, that it's a very discreet meeting. It wasn't something publicized where they had a press conference after the fact, but it wasn't this sort of, you know, day four of the summit. I mean, it was really about airing the grievances and sort of breaking down what these beefs have become.
Yeah, this was not a publicity stunt at all. This was people who were generally afraid that hip hop might not survive all this carnage. And they knew that the music was on an unsustainable path. So Snoop Dogg, actually, he had been maybe the toughest of all these guys, like a serious Crip with wearing his blue bandana. But he knew he had to make a change, and he sort of spearheaded this effort. And Ice Cube also was willing to be like, you know, I really shouldn't have picked a fight with you, Common. That was pretty dumb. A lot of people thought that Common sort of won their lyrical diss battle anyway. So I think Ice Cube realized it was time to throw in the towel.
It's also interesting to see the omissions, because Dr. Dre was not involved, because Dr. Dre, I would say Dr. Dre in your book is one of the central characters, because at this point, you know, you think of him involved in these beasts, but he wasn't. He was withdrawn. He spent some time in jail off a DUI when he had a parole, but he stayed away from this stuff. And surprising to me, and it was an eye-opener, you know, he hasn't done much at all collaborating with Tupac, was not really involved in some of the sort of, you know, those relationships that we know today to be the sort of the big beefs.
Yeah, well, at the time that Tupac was joining Death Row, Dr. Dre was ready to leave Death Row. Suge Knight, who was the head of Death Row, was engaged in all sorts of craziness, and there were gang members in the studios. There were people getting beat up, and Dr. Dre just wanted to make music. He didn't want any part of this. So he bowed out, and it was really Tupac and Suge who were all about the aggression against the East Coast and things like that. But meanwhile, Dr. Dre left Death Row, the label he helped start, which was selling, you know, $100 million company with nothing. And he basically just said, you can have it. I want to start my own label. I want out of this. And then soon after, he discovered Eminem and really made a go of it himself.
In a whole different way. You know, Ben, the book is called Original Gangsters, and it's a book that really tells the, it tells the untold story, and it does, because it reads like an investigative report. I mean, you go into court documents. You really sort of set up chapters of these entertainers' lives. You interviewed a lot of these guys. They gave you access, some in some probably quicker version than others, and it's been over the last couple years. What's the through line? I mean, are they excited to talk about the glory days of the West Coast rap days? I mean, what's the takeaway from a lot of the players that are in this book that you had a chance to talk to?
Well, I think it's odd. It's funny in a way that now we've come to, you know, when I was growing up, you had classic rock radio, and now we've gotten to the point where it's classic hip hop radio, and there's all sorts of channels. And this era, you know, it was dangerous. It was the crack era. There was high violence. But now there's almost sort of a nostalgia towards it. And, you know, the guys that I talk to are really proud of even the peripheral players being involved with this music and this movement that still resonates. Last year you had Straight Outta Compton, the movie, was a huge hit. NWA got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's a Tupac movie coming out. So this era is really as big a part of the public consciousness as it's ever been.
I was going to say, I mean, for you, you wrote the Dirty South book, which looks at some tremendous rappers, Lil Wayne, Outkast. When you think of the West Coast scene that was created here that is now having such success in, as we all reminisce about it, when you think of the canon of hip-hop as we know it, where does this scene stand? I mean, is it the biggest scene that's ever come out of hip-hop?
Well, I don't know if it's the biggest. It might be among the most lucrative, you know, because nowadays, because of digital downloading and streaming, no one makes any money at all. And this era was at a time when Suge Knight could buy like $10,000 diamond pendants for everyone and their mothers, literally. But I think this was the most exciting era of hip hop to me, at least, because the music was great. And the behind-the-scenes story were so insane. So that's where I'd put it.
You know, listeners to this program will know that we have a lot of different artists in Chicago, some hip-hop artists who will come on. And we've talked about different scenes. Do you think that there can be another scene like this? I mean, we've seen a little bit with the drill scene here in Chicago with Chief Keef and others sort of doing this reality rap, rapping about the things around them. Do you see what's old again becomes new when it comes to hip-hop?
Absolutely. I think that the drill scene here in Chicago is really a direct descendant of what Eazy-E started. Eazy-E made it okay to rap about whatever you want, really. You didn't have to try to sugarcoat it. And that's, you know, you wouldn't call what's happening today gangster rap necessarily, but it has a lot of the same themes and it has the same sort of like, don't give an F attitude that I think Eazy would appreciate.
The last thing, you know, it's so interesting because you think about all of these stories that, you know, you report in the book, whether it be in clubs, altercations, situations like you mentioned with Dr. Dre in the club with D. Barnes. These are all situations that happened before social media. You know, and you wonder if today this radical, really reckless behavior would be corrected quickly because of social media and the, being able to put on Instagram and other places like, look what I just saw. I mean, do you think that you can have this kind of reckless behavior in a world where now everything is documented?
I think definitely someone like Dr. Dre, who's accused by four different women of beating, would have been taken to task a lot sooner. That's one thing. One of the women he allegedly beat, Terry B, says that Eazy-E and Jerry Heller paid her for her silence, and that's the kind of thing I don't think could happen anymore. But yeah, it's one thing I think about when thinking about this era is that there's probably a ton of even crazier stuff that we just will never know about.
We'll never know. Ben Westhoff is a journalist, a music journalist, and he's the author of Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. He's going to be at Volumes Books Cafe in Wicker Park, 1474 North Milwaukee, tomorrow night, reading from the book and signing. Ben, thanks so much for coming in and being in the Big Table.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Justin.
One, two. Bring it to the folks. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the dope. Ready to make an entrance, so back on up. Cause you know we're about to rip this up. Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together, now you know you in trouble. Ain't nothing but a G-thang, baby. Too low depth.
I'll never listen to this music the same way after reading this book. I'm telling you, man. It's so interesting. Like, that, like Snoop was a kid from Long Beach, and it's almost stereotypical to be like, oh yeah, Snoop was a gangbanger who sold drugs. think about like where they're at now, where Snoop Dogg is a spokesman. I mean, he's a celebrity. He's an entertainer. Like he's a pitch man.
Pals around with Martha Stewart.
Right. The thing from the days in Long Beach. I mean, hey. 630 says you can't compare today's rappers or hip hop artists to Dre, Eazy, Q, Pac. And the West and East Coast rappers, it's just disrespectful. I don't know. I think that they're good, but I do think that the rappers today, including Kanye West, do have similar or, if not, better...
Lamar.
Kendrick Lamar, who is a Dr. Dre protege. I grew up in metal, this 815, and NWA and Public Enemy, plus a lynch mob, were popular crossover music back then. I think metal fans actually helped the rap scene.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Waxes for Anthrax.
Yeah, right. I think there's something to that, you know, because there was I think that kind of concept of being rebellious music has been talked about. This idea that it wasn't necessarily about, you know, as I think a lot of people mischaracterize why young white kids were listening to that music, like, oh, you just want to be black. It wasn't that. It was that they liked the rebellious style, that they were saying things that weren't allowed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's traditional in music. I mean, Elvis Presley, right? The Beatles, Rolling Stones. And you think about all the bands in metal was very similar. I mean, we're not talking about hair metal type stuff, but Guns N' Roses and even some of the more Metallicas and stuff, they said things that, you know, or at least brought music to a different level. So really interesting. I'm glad to read that book, man. Like I said, that was 24 hours of some sheer West Coast rap. Like, I might have to take a week off from my West Coast rap Spotify channel. But you know what was really great? Is that I read this book with my phone. You know, so I read it with I had my phone on me. So whenever I got to a point where they're like, Ben would be like, and then this track came out and it was a big distance. I would look it up.
Go back and listen to it.
Yeah. And so you're like listening back to Ice Cube or Dre and your stuff that's not the norm, you know, not the hits. And there's this one great, this whole thing about Terry B. It was a white woman that Eazy-E signed rapper, first sort of white female rapper in the late 80s. And she had a diss track and she dissed Dr. Dre on it because Dre wanted to produce a record because everything that Ruthless Records Eazy-E did, Dre produced, but she wouldn't have it. And so she dissed him on the track, right? And it was a famous kind of track, but I had never heard it. So I went back and listened to it, and it was terrible. She should have had Dre produce it. But it was really interesting because in the story, which is really evil, is that he got upset. Usually, you know, especially at that time, rappers didn't, they didn't get that upset, but because maybe it was, there was personal, and because she was a woman, whatever it was, he got upset, and then they were at a some sort of record release party or whatever, and he hit her, like, in front of everybody. And you're just like, yeah, that's just not, I don't, you know, like, I mean, he's very, I would say that Dr. Dre is a pretty lucky guy in the sense that he had this despicable, deplorable behavior that just was missed. Or at the time in the 80s, mm-hmm. it was okay to do that. If he did that today, he wouldn't sell any records. He'd be in jail.
Yeah.
And the idea that he somehow was able to... This was before The Chronic. This was before now when he's on the Beats by Dre headphones and the Apple commercials and Kendrick Lamar's in the studio and he's working on stuff. Or he's got a Sprite or whatever that is, right? This was, you know, so all of this behavior was dismissed. And he had a career, a multi-million dollar career after that. Anyway, coming up, John Glazer, Jess Godwin. We've got a good show coming up. Stay with us.